So I'm going to preface this with a little bit of a warning. We ran a little bit long with this episode, and we do apologize. We do try to keep them around an hour, but there's a lot of really good discussion, and it was really hard to cut out a lot of the information. So again, sorry. It is a little bit long, but we do hope you enjoy it nonetheless. And thank you for listening. Welcome to the Danger Room, a place to prepare for the opponents you are yet to face. We discuss strategy and how to level up your game in Marvel Crisis Protocol. We will have our Xavier Protocol segment, some hot takes discussing something new and shiny, and our main topic of the week. We would like to begin by thanking you, the listener, for giving us your time to listen to our opinions of the game. On the podcast, we have Jacob, Sploosh, and myself, Dizzard. To start off, we're going to be discussing Doctor Strange. Jacob, what are your thoughts on Stephen Strange?
To break the mold, I am super excited about Doctor Strange coming out. I'm building all sorts of rosters around him. I think he brings something a bit different to what we've seen in five threat characters. We saw a little bit of this with Ebony Maw, but he's a really good control. He's like fantastic control piece. I think one of the things I like about him most is his push on his builder attack is not a push away or a push towards. It's just a straight up push. You can move them in any direction you like. And it's the first sort of time we've seen that. We've seen throws in any direction, but those sort of wild activation pushes nearly always have an away clause. This one doesn't. So it just means you are going to be able to position those pieces wherever you want. Add that in with Crimson Bands of Sycorax, and he's just got such a great suite of control abilities. He's incredibly difficult to take down as well with his healing and with his defensive rerolls, thanks to his Eye of Agamotto. He's just going to be a pain to remove off the table. He's going to take a significant amount of resource if you want to focus fire him down. And that's going to be a huge advantage in defenders because he's the leader, and removing the leader is always a good thing to do if you can do it. And he's going to be very hard to remove.
So I think he's an interesting character. He doesn't really fit my playstyle too much, personally. So I'm going to disagree with you. But my biggest thing with him is he's got a lot going on. He's going to bring a lot of interesting things to the game. Being able to just turn off a player's activation ability, like just, hey, you can't activate this turn, will be interesting to see. Sure, it's not going to come up too terribly often. I think your math shows it. If you have everything going right for you, it's around 50%, if I remember correctly.
I think it's about 50% base, and if you throw some stuff, some cards or something at it, then you can get it up to like mid-60s.
Yeah, so it's like it does have a good chance at popping, and it'll be annoying when it does, but I think it'll be neat. It's a cute hat trick. I do think he's going to bring a lot of questions to the game that we don't have the answer for yet, to be honest. That's basically my hot take on it. I think he is actually a character that might change the overall state of the game. Sploosh?
Yeah, I'd like to start with two questions for Jacob, because since he's a little high on it, and I'll admit that I'm lukewarm and unconvinced, but open to him being awesome. One is, he has the same defense as Ghost Rider, which you didn't seem as keen about. With the 3-4-4, and the other one is, how stapled is soul gem? How much would you take the soul gem on this guy?
Okay, so my issue with Ghost Rider was that he didn't have any defensive tech. He had no ways of re-rolling, no ways of getting extra dice, no ways of counting blanks, any of that stuff that we've seen on other characters. Stephen Strange can just go, I didn't like that roll. I'm going to pick up all of the dice, including the skulls, and roll them again. It's like having a built-in one-sided recalibration matrix for him against every single attack. I think it's a completely different ball game when you're looking at defense compared to Ghost Rider. So that is top shelf defensive tech right there. I think the Soul Gem, it depends what you want to do with him. if you want to be getting off regular Crimson Bands of Sycorax, if that's what you're building around, then absolutely you need to take the Soul Gem. That's going to give him the power that he needs to do that. If that's a nice extra and that's not what you're building around, which I think might be a better way to play him. So I depends on exactly how what your roster composition is, and giving up not only the extra threat, but the slot in your roster is quite a big opportunity cost. So I can see a lot of people going, I don't think I need the Soul Gem with him. And then he's going to be getting that, he's going to be using that big spender attack with that big splashy effect less often. But I suspect that's actually going to make you have to be a better player with him. I think it's great to throw Doctor Strange at someone and go, yeah, maybe I'll, you know, mean that you just can't activate. And that will really, really help and maybe make up for some play mistakes if I get lucky. Whereas I think not relying on that ability as much will make you a better player with Doctor Strange.
Yeah, I definitely, that's the one I need to see proven to me. The Soul Gem is definitely scary with him because nobody likes the idea of their character just activating without doing anything. That's pretty bad. The fact that the stagger is guaranteed is huge as well. So that's definitely something that, you know, makes him unique. I just want to talk about his leadership. So the exciting part of Doctor Strange, without anything else known about him, is the fact that he can give every character in the game basically the potential for energy or mystic or maybe even physical if that's somebody's weakness. That really opens up the game for counters and counterplay and creating puzzles that are hard to solve or answering someone else's puzzle, you know. So that's pretty cool. I think it's a really cool move for the game. You know, the obvious, and I think we talked about it a while ago, was the fact that it's pretty cool against web warriors and a lot of the like hotness that's going on right now. And I really think that's a cool addition to the game.
Worth just reminding people that it is only once per turn, so you can't do it on a character who's got a charge and then makes two attacks, or someone who generates extra attacks through flurries, or something like Corvus Glaive and Proxima Midnight, where they both activate on the same turn. They can't, if you've got any weird tech that's going to mean you get multiple activations back to back, you can't use that more than once per turn.
Yeah, and it's got goofy interactions with the, oh man, what's the name of the card? The Doom Prophecy. You have to be physical when you do the attack, and if your character isn't good at physical, then it only works once, and it's probably not worth it. So, yeah. I don't know. So my thing about him is the fact that he only has a 5-dice attack and not a 6-dice attack. That's kind of a thing for the 5-costers, where they all have 6-dice attacks. The effect is pretty solid, though. Like you said, the ability to move away or towards is really good.
Okay, let me ask you this. Captain Marvel, do you like her 5-dice strike or her 4-dice reroll all better?
4-dice reroll.
Why is that?
It's more consistent, and energy is pretty good.
Okay, so Doctor Strange, he can reroll all of his attack dice. Now, it is an all, not an any, so it's not quite analogous with Captain Marvel. But, you know, when you're rolling Thor and you just get that really awful roll and you just go, oh, right, Thor, you're just not doing anything this turn. That happens surprisingly often. And I think that 5 with the ability to just pick up the dice and reroll all of them is, that's going to, over the course of games, that's going to be more consistent and therefore better.
All right. Yeah, maybe. And I don't know if you already did an article, but I might want to see that. Convincing me that 5-dice attack is as good as a 6-dice attack. Maybe there's math behind that.
Oh no, it's not as good. It's better.
Oh, all right. Well, there you go. That's the hot take.
It's going to have less potential for spikes because you're rolling fewer dice, and so you won't get as many crits as you can with 6-dice. But it's going to be consistently. If you're looking to try and get like 4 hits, it's going to be better to do 5, and I reroll all of them if I want to.
Yeah, and skulls don't hurt you.
Yeah.
And crits are sweet. Yeah, you roll the crit, and then the crit rolls into a skull. Who cares? You roll 6 dice again, you know?
You roll 7.
Yeah, and if you roll crits on the first one, and so you've rolled 5 dice and you get 2 crits, you've then got 7 dice. Admittedly, the crits don't go again, but you're now picking up 7 dice and rolling all of those again.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. So, okay, so maybe my problem is I was focusing on him spiking damage like MODOK might do, but he is just consistently even or better. And that's something that has value.
Well, I don't think he's looking for a spike though, is the thing too. When with other characters you're looking for the spike. I think he's perfectly fine not needing that spike.
Another thing which you may not have thought of, I might pick up the dice and re-roll a spike, going, that is too much power I am giving my opponent. I do not want to do that much damage to them this turn. I don't want to give them all that power because they're going to come straight back at me. Wasn't enough to daze them. I'm going to pick up those dice and hope for less hits.
That's interesting. I usually just like doing lots of damage, but that definitely could be a strategic play. Where maybe they... Okay, so you roll your dice, they roll their dice. Their dice are all blanks with no rerolls, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know you can't kill them. That's solid information, right? Because maybe you're hoping for just one damage to get the push away.
Or the wild, yeah.
Yeah, well, you don't even need a wild with the bolt of...
Oh, yeah. The devil. Yeah, right.
Yeah. Okay, you're starting to convince me. He's definitely unique to the fives. Most of the fives want to murder things. And he's more of a... I'm pretty good at killing, but I'm also great at keeping my team alive. His leadership, like I said earlier, is... might bring life to maybe a few characters that needed a little boost. Obviously just one attack, but sometimes with something like Black Dwarf, he only gets one attack anyway. He might as well make it a good one. And then the insane way it works with Vision, where he can make the entire beam a psychic or mystic attack, you know.
Yeah, that's whatever. Very good. Yeah. One final thing is, I think you want to be including him on teams who don't want priority. I don't think you want to put him on a kill team, because when he gets that Bands of Sycorax off, then that is going to probably lose you priority, because that activated token means that character is not activating. You're much more likely to have the last activation in the turn and therefore lose priority. So when you're building your teams with him, you want to bear that in mind as well.
Oh, and that also really kind of plays into like the talks you've had recently with Omnus, Omnus Protocol, is those control teams really don't mind not having priority, and it plays right into your talk of him being a very control-esque character.
Absolutely.
Do you see him in other affiliations?
Yes, I do. I think he could bring some much-needed control to Guardians. Guardians, quite often, you've got a large team anyway. Because you've got those cheap characters, so you might be going for, you know, a 6 or 7 character team. Even at 5 threat, he can still fit into those, and you're going to be losing priority anyway. But what Guardians really lack is good control options. Ronan's good. He's not kind of got a typical control that you might normally see in MCP, but I can see Doc Strange fitting in there. I can see him going really nicely with Wakanda. We talked about, him wanting to go with teams that want to go last. Very often Wakanda wants to go last. And potentially with Web Warriors as well. I haven't quite figured out what that looks like, but I can see that there's the kernel of a good idea there.
Huh. Yeah, I can see his defensive ability being really cool at Rocket Raccoon. As you were talking in the last episode about cover, giving someone 2 extra dice and the auto cover could be pretty good.
Pretty good.
So,
all right.
So I guess to wrap up his hot takes, is Doctor Strange going to be meta changing?
Yes.
Yeah, for sure. I just don't know where he fits in that meta. That's all.
That's fair. I agree. I think I already said it once. I do think he will be meta changing. I'm not hot on the character because he doesn't quite play to everything that I like, but I'm probably going to like him. Even especially this conversation, I like him a little bit more, to be honest. So we're going to jump into everyone's favorite segment of the show, being Xavier Protocols, which will tie really well into today's episode. Jacob?
Yeah, so we're going to be talking about the different crises and kind of things you need for them. So I wanted to look at the maths of the energy interact crises. So we're looking here at the spider portals and the meteor origin bomb crisis, the one where you have to spend a power, roll your energy defense, and try and hit a certain number of successes of crits, wilds, and hits on the dice. And so just to recap some of the maths of that, one thing that I always jumps out at me is people write off two dice characters. They go, you just can't play Venom on these kind of crises because he's only got two energy defense. Well, you can play Venom on there because so long as he's not contesting something, one that's got anyone on, he's still got a 75% chance of rolling one success. So that's, you know, it's not awful. It's not guaranteed. But getting Venom up into a position where he can throw some punches or maybe take some punches and then use some so many snacks. I think Venom's not as awful as maybe he's made out to be on these crises because he can activate first, go up, and stand a decent chance of claiming that and then be in a good position for the rest of the game. One that I really like, which I think surprises a lot of people, is if you're trying to get two successes on three dice, a lot of people would think, you know, you're only rolling three dice, what's your chance? Two successes. Doesn't seem very likely. It's a 50-50. It's a coin flip when you're going up with three dice and trying to get two successes. So there's one other person contesting that objective from your opponents. It can happen. It's not super likely, but, you know, it's like I say, it's a coin flip. And, of course, four dice is better, but it's still not loads better. We're looking at 69% there. So yes, more dice is going to be better in terms of trying to claim the objectives, but it's not. Three dice is still good. And I think three dice, particularly with a pull or a throw, is probably better than four dice. Because if you're looking at the comparison between one success on three dice and two successes on four dice, three dice is better. Two successes on three dice and three successes on four dice, three dice is better. So don't immediately think you must have four energy defense. Three energy defense with the ability to move someone is better than four energy defense. It's worth a couple of things I just want to touch on. The reality gem. The reality gem does skew this because you get to add skulls as to that equation as well. And it just makes everything better. So you've got a 66% chance of getting two successes with three dice with the reality gem. That's nearly the same as the 69% with four dice. So reality gem, good. But I think we all knew that. One final thing, which is a bit people often forget about, is this is a crisis which you can take damage from if you roll a skull when you're interacting, particularly on the meteors, or it teleports you on the portal. So there are downsides, and the chances of those coming up go up as you roll more dice. So on two dice, you're looking at a 23% chance. At three dice, that's 33. So one in three chance of you getting that negative effect. And with four dice, it goes up to 41%. So it's becoming really quite high. Another reason that I really like three dice with a throw or a push over four dice is you're more likely to get the objective flipped and you're less likely to get the negative effect. Again, the reality gem really skews this because you've one of those skulls, you can just say that's a crit there. So with three dice with the reality gem, you're only looking at a 4% chance of getting it. Pretty safe negative effect if you have the reality gem, which I think is a pretty fitting way of bringing the reality gem into the game.
Yeah, you make some really good points with that, and it really will play into what we're going to talk about later with the whole meteor scenario. So going into the main topic of today, this week Jacob has broken down the crisis available currently into different groups. Do you want to go over that real quick and explain why you group them this way?
Sure. So what we're going to try and do is try and talk about the crises and say, what are the things you want to be thinking about when you're building a team for this particular crisis? And so we're not going to be pairing them up. We're going to be looking at them individually. But there are a lot of them now. We're getting to the point where it's quite unwieldy, the amount of crises to talk about. So it needed to be grouped together a bit. So where we think there are similar things to say about the crises, we group them together. So for example, the ones I've just talked about, the spider portals and the deadly meteor origin bomb ones, because they've got a similar mechanic, because you retain control when you move away from it and you have to roll energy dice, even though they've got a different shape deployment, we've lumped those two together because we think that you can broadly say the same things about those crises. In the same way, we've grouped together the cosmic cube fragments and the spider infected, where there's five extracts that give you one VP each and they're spread out. We think that there's similar things to say about those. And the two D shapes that aren't the ones that require the role, the interact role. So Extremis and the cosmic portals, again, we've put those together. Although they are different,
So Sploosh, we kind of touched on this last week, but why is Crisis Selecting important for your specific roster?
I do think we're at a point in the game where no matter what affiliation you pick, there will be Crisis that you will want to take and favor you. So the way the game works is you'll pick three secures and three extracts, right? And the best way to look at it is you only really need two good ones because you're always discarding one. And as long as you don't discard both of them, then you have one or the other to take. So it's kind of like an A or B is your favorite. So in theory, you would like to have two of your favorites in secure and extract. And I think once you hear us go over all of these cards, you're going to kind of realize, and it might work for you to understanding further how this works and which ones are the ones you want to pick for your affiliation. We do want to try to future-proof this conversation a little bit, so we may not get too deep into like describing every affiliation and exactly what cards they want to take, but we will try our best to describe why you take them and kind of understand and be able to read the signals in what we're saying and which affiliation may like which one. And you do obviously want to keep in mind that your opponent doesn't have your best interests in mind, so they will most likely be trying to pick the one that you're not good at. So it's also your job during roster building to have a plan for your favorite cards and also have a plan for your least favorite cards. And just because we say a card is not really good for certain affiliations doesn't actually mean it's a bad choice either. Most likely, I'd say about half of these cards are probably break even for every affiliation, which means it's maybe a 50-50 and you won't get any advantages or disadvantages. And that's also fine. It's just our goal will be to try to help you pick your favorites. And, you know, once you understand the strengths and weaknesses of each one, you can try to figure out how to counteract those and maybe have an answer.
Yeah, I think that's explained very well. So I'll start off by talking about Alien Ship and Scrolls. The biggest thing with these is you're only going to have one extract. Sure, it's 2 points, but it's only one extract, and it really depends on how you roll. It's RNG based, it's one extract, and it's I feel like with this one, you really need to have a wide team. Give you more chances to go for it, or you could play the whole I'm gonna let my opponent grab it and then I'm gonna take it from them and run away with it. I definitely do think that this is an objective that you kind of want to grab the objective and get that person like away from the fight, so that way you can try and hold it for as long as possible. It definitely helps you get a bigger swing in games because there's only one extract. Like it's pretty straightforward there. So with speaking specifically on like the Greek core, you have a 20 point objective. I think this is really good for teams that want to go super wide. So that I'm looking at like Guardians. I think Web Warriors kind of like it just in the fact that they can really spread out and take more heavier cost characters, like throw MODOK in there. And those lists that you don't really plan for, as well as like, again, I mentioned this in the last episode, a lot of people don't actually plan for 20, surprisingly. So it catches people off guard a lot of times. And then my high points on Scrolls is, and it kind of applies to Alien Ship as well, is you can shift the fight easy. You can't really plan for it, but if, say, you have all of your flank on one side and you have one guy trying to get the objective on the other side and you actually hit it on that one, if the other person wants to get that extract, he's going to go chase down that character who's off by themselves. So you kind of have to like think about that in your planning is, do I want to split up my force to try and make this fight on one side or the other? Or do I want to just force one side and really hope I get lucky and roll that RNG? I would say, in my experience, a lot of people don't like these two objectives. Number one, because of the RNG that's involved with them. And two is because it's that singular extract. And that's basically what it comes down to. What are your guys' thoughts on that?
I think this is definitely the kind of thing that slows the game down. You're scoring fewer victory points. Compare it to some of those where you can score 4 or 5 victory points a turn off extracts. Here you're only scoring 2. That's going to favor the teams who want to go longer into the game, maybe to leverage an attrition advantage. That's the typical one. So if you're building a kill team and you want to make sure that you've got time to make the attacks you need to make to get the advantage you need, This can stop them from a team racing away with the game early. They just can't get as many victory points on this extract. It's worth mentioning the reality gem. It does really increase your chance. You go from a 25% chance to a 50% chance. And that's actually about the same as having two people activate and have a go at it. So it's power efficient, and it just increases your odds. And then once you've got it, it helps you survive, because the reality gem helps your defense as well as your offense as well as your interact. So if you're looking at including Thanos with reality or Corvus with reality, this is definitely something you should be thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I'll first just say that, in my opinion, as a kind of competitive, maybe overly competitive player, but also as someone who's played this game casually when I first started with no intention of being competitive, I found both of these to be sort of a negative play experience. I don't know if anyone here listening has their own story, but I played these three in a row with a friend. The reasoning was that my friend kept getting it on the first turn with a crit. And I was like, well, this game doesn't feel fair. And let's play it again. Let's just see if you got lucky. And he kept doing it. And obviously, statistically, that was extremely lucky and very unlikely. But at the end of it, it just left me with a really bad taste in my mouth. I was like, this isn't fun. I went to a tournament. It was like a casual when they gave out the cool cards for Red Skull and Cap. And I was playing against people who've never played the game before. And I had played like three games. You know, I felt a little experienced. And we played one of these in one of the games. And at one point, I got the scroll or whatever. And my opponent's just like, well, now you're just going to like run away. And that kind of sucks. And he was right. I was like, well, I don't want this game to be not fun. But like, if I want to win, it's kind of in my best interest to run away now. So, okay. It was lose-lose for me. And I was the guy who could win. So that being said, as a competitive player, these cards are like a virus to me. I can't imagine playing them personally. When the reality gem came out, everybody was talking about how, oh, I'm going to play with the reality gem and these cards are good now and even competitive players can play them. So I had my friends and I, we played this objective twice in a row. And the first game, I got the thing with the reality Corvus and I was like, haha, look, we've solved it. This is the way to play. Then the next game, I whiffed. My opponent got the card on the first try on the opposite side of the board. And we actually just called the game immediately because we're like, okay, you're going to go here. I'm going to do this and I can't win. The other part of RNG that no one talks about is you have no idea what secure your opponent's going to pick. So for example, if they pick Gamma and then like take 15, now you don't have that like wide option. If you're sending some fluffy little character out into the gammas to get burned to death, you don't know if you're going to win the object. And then maybe you do like on your second try and your four health character is half health. And your opponent's just like, all right, thanks for getting that for me. I'm just going to move over there and kill your guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and probably he has initiative because he's the killy list and you're the guy with like the go wide, try to get a, you know, alien ship or whatever.
Yeah.
I have seen people play these in events like online and they've been streamed and things. I had, you know, a few games where I got to see that. And it was interesting to me because the player who was playing it, he actually said he loved them. And funny enough, the RNG was working out for him in like most of the games. And I was just like, man, this isn't fair. Like, he's not even getting punished for these choices. So that is a thing, though. If you want to spike a game and kind of, someone might say, steal a game, these are the good cards to pick.
Actually, it's a point that the guys on Strike Better made. If you're going up, if you see you're paired up against Sploosh, and you're like, oh no. I'm against a really good player. No, but I'm against this really good player. I reckon their skill is so much higher than mine. They've got so many more reps in than me. I've only managed to get a few games in. It's a valid strategy to go, well, I'm going to try and level that playing field by putting in the RNG type crisis. Maybe that will help me.
Yeah, I think I'll leave it at that. But there is RNG in what they pick. Gamma is just one of the options. You don't even know what the other thing they pick is. You know, and you probably, they like a D situation is kind of okay because then two of the objectives are like on the D objectives, the D secures, right? Mm-hmm. So that's okay. However, they do require power to interact with, which favors, you know, people who get a lot of power, right? And some people don't. Like, web warriors struggle with power, so the interact might be a gamble. I've seen games where someone spent like 7 interactions failing this, and their opponent spent 2 and succeeded. So you just lost all that power, you know? It went into the pits of hell, you know?
So I guess
that's the thing to think about. Sorry, do you want to add to that?
I was just going to say, like, that kind of just brings into like what I was saying earlier is, I think a viable tactic with both of these scenarios is either leave it alone or let your opponent go for it. Yeah, it's going to slow the game down, but using your power more efficiently, if you are an affiliation that struggles with power, let your opponent go for it or just leave it there and go for the secures. And that could be a way to play these scenarios effectively. Sure, it'll slow the game down. It'll probably go to round 6. But if your affiliation struggles with that power generation, then it might be your better option just to say, well, I see Krikor, I'm going to take advantage of playing at 20, and I'm just going to beat you up and take over the secures.
Sure, and there's RNG in how the game is even played. Like, mm-hmm. you can't depend on it being a slow game. They mm-hmm. might just get it on turn 1. It becomes a fast game. It becomes a maybe crazy game, you know? It might be, you know, everyone ignores it, and the game slows down. Someone gets it quick, it becomes quick, fast game. You're right about Web Warriors and Miles being able to, like, do the zap and steal the objective, which is really cool. But that also, if it's a D secure, Miles might be, like, in the wrong place. And can you afford to put Miles in the middle of the board waiting for something to happen? And then, you know, it comes down to priority, and it becomes RNG, which is randomness. I just want to add one last thing that is kind of cool that I noticed by accident. I bought a mat on, I forget where, somewhere in the United Kingdom, I believe, and they had all the objective tokens marked on the board, which is probably the part of the game I enjoyed the least in real life. And just for fun, I was playing with MODOK because he's my favorite guy. And I realized that if you're playing on a B map, which if I know I don't memorize these things, the B is like the infinity formula, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you can remember infinity formula, if you put MODOK on range 1 of the serum, he can actually reach the decoy, which is kind of cool. So he's scoring for you and then can kind of, when he's bored, try to score. That applies to all characters of the same base size as MODOK, which would be like, you know, Black Dwarf or Hulk or something.
Yeah, so Jacob, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about Wakanda Herbs?
Okay. This is probably the slowest of any of the crises. It's really, really hard to score your herb against who's played this like once. It's just so easy to push a character away off the altar, pull them closer to your deployment, making it harder for them to get back, and then that one move is gonna make it an extra turn for them to move back, so they can only move once a turn. So it's a slow scenario, which is great if you're coming up against a fast team. If you want to play against Wakanda, this is a great crisis to drop Wakandan team, and you know some Wakandan players are picking extracts specifically to avoid playing this crisis. How much it messes with their strategy. There are some cute ways of trying to score your herb early. I've written about quite a few of them on xavier-protocols.com. Go and check those out. But all of them have got relatively simple counterplay. Normally, it's a simple push or a pull somewhere in the middle of the round. So someone like Valkyrie, who can move up twice and throw someone, is invaluable at negating those kinds of plays. So you can try and have some jank tech to try and score that 4 points. And if you get it, great. But it's very easy to disrupt if you know what's coming. So be aware of those so you don't fall foul of them. So what this wants is it wants teams that can capitalize on a long game. So either very durable teams or very killy teams who get to make more attacks because the game is going on. The more attacks they make, the more likely those killy teams are to win. So when you're looking at this, you want to be thinking about, am I going to try and score the herb? If so, what's my jank? Who are my characters who can maybe have an extra move? Someone like Zemo who can make an attack, and then that generates a move from his Steel Rush. If you've got someone like Ghost Rider who's got that ability to make an extra move, you might need some way of getting power onto them, but that's one thing to look at. The other thing to say is I'm just going to ignore the hurt scoring, and I'm going to have a big hitty character go and pick it up and get buffs to their attacks. That is a totally viable strategy for this, and say, you know what, I'm never going to score it, but I'm going to treat it like plus one. So I'm just going to go and grab it and make that attacking character. That can work well.
It's only physical attacks, though.
Sure, you need the right character, but it's great on her.
Yeah.
Which, you mentioned Ghost Rider, and as we were talking about this, I started thinking, Ghost Rider is actually really good at Wakanda Nerve, because if you get it just to hold it, it makes his 6-die attack now a 7-die attack. Wait, was changed energy?
No, it's energy. Physical.
Okay, yeah, energy. Yeah, so... Oh, it is energy? Okay, well, I guess...
It's energy, energy, mystic.
Okay, my bad. So, never mind, forget that. But, however, I do think there is a viable play with Ghost Rider scoring on herbs with a drop-off and his extra movement shenanigans. Could be interesting to play.
Maybe, but you need 3 power for his movement shenanigans plus 1 power to pick up the herb, so you need 4 power. It's probably not happening turn one.
No.
Also then have still got the problem that you've got this character who's size 3, so it's easy to draw line of sight to him. And all it takes is someone like Shuri to go, and I push you off from range 5.
Yeah.
It's there as an option, but I think the reality is in most games it's not happening. I'll also add that it's a 15-point objective, which sort of is the nail in the coffin, because if someone chooses the 15 or maybe like 17 as an alternative because of secures, you just don't really have the character numbers that are required to play a secure game and also deal with the extract. And usually what happens if people are playing conservatively, they'll sort of position on their side of the board with their herb, which means the other opponent may do the same thing, and then you're sort of like away from each other, just having this like nickel and dime game and trying to take a little bit of supremacy on the board. But by the time it matters, you know, the game might be over, or your characters are all wounded and you can't afford to try to take an herb and run away because they'll just chase you down. I've used this card to counter Wakanda, but obviously Wakanda may not be the only affiliation that hates this card. There's potentially new affiliations that will also hate this card. It's a card that is so unlikely to actually grab this thing that I've actually played this card in multiple league games, and I don't even remember what the text of it is. All I know is I'm playing it as this counter card, not to actually interact with it.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of its most commonly used uses. I've seen it through games that you've played, other people, and Jacob mentioned it earlier, is some people will just play it and not like, planning on not even scoring with it. You're saying you use it as a counter, so it's a very viable option. Sploosh, let's go on to the next one. What are your thoughts on the Infinity Formula?
Well, first of all, Infinity Formula is the one you're going to play potentially the most. Isn't there stats to like confirm this? But I feel like you're either playing Infinity Formula or Gamma, like as the most popular secures in the game. It's this like average 17, which like it feels like just 17 is like how the game was introduced and how it's evolved, and everyone just thinks of 17 as like that middle ground number. The reason I say that is like you need to probably learn how to play this even if you're not going to put it in your list, because it's going to be very commonly coming up for you. It creates this scenario where there is sort of a left and a right. I discussed this a little bit in our previous episode, that some people like to play that way, where they sort of take their roster, split it in half, and then sort of play two different games. And that is an option on this. So you may want to also yourself have an idea of either how to play like that yourself or counter it. That also creates a lot of cool counterplay, and it's one of the reasons this game is really fun, is because this secure here is really introducing us to like how the game works, with which direction do you send certain characters, and do you want to counter those characters or not. And if you make the wrong decision, it can be really costly. If you put your characters far away from each other in the beginning on turn zero and then regret your decision, it takes a while to recalibrate yourself and fix it, and that can be costly. So speaking more directly of the card, the way that it's a B formation, which allows characters with range five to kind of interact with each other in sort of this like crossfire. And that opens up characters like Shuri and Hawkeye, that kind of thing. Also, the power gain is key. So during the power phase, you gain an extra power. So that opens up lists that have power issues. The super obvious example is Web Warriors, was a recent topic we've had in episode one. If you're playing against Web Warriors, you may not want to play this objective because it brings them online quickly and it helps, you know, sort of improve them. And that's interesting, really. This is a card that kind of is all positive. Giving people power, there's no negativity there. There's some of these cards, they have these negative effects. And, you know, if you're someone who just, you know, doesn't want to have to deal with any negative effects, just gain power, this is the one for you. I don't know if there's much more to say other than it's just really popular. People like gaining power. Some lists really want to gain power more than others, and so it's really good for them. And you do want to like keep in mind the way the scenario works and how things go left or right. And there's just like this dead zone when you play this objective is what I'm trying to say. If you, there's really not a lot of reason to be in the middle once the game gets going, but you may want to start in the middle early on. This objective also combos quite well with the rescue the civilian, since the civilian will be sitting on the objective, so you don't have to go very far. And yeah, for most characters, even the average character who just gains one power per turn, moving over, picking up a civilian, and then standing there waiting for your two power the next turn, it gets the game going more quickly. And actually, that's another point. So this might be considered a fast objective because you can score more quickly and it gets the offense or the actions and the abilities going at a rapid rate. I don't know if there is more to say other than I think this objective caters towards a lot of teams as well, which is probably why it's played so much. It's good for killing teams. It's good for objective teams. Arguably, maybe even good for control teams too, since it has that crossfire effect. I actually struggle to think of any team that doesn't like this card. It's just very good.
Yeah, there's a lot of people just benefit from it because of the extra power generation, and it's like, well, I'm gonna sit here and be able to do all the cool attacks that I don't normally get to do as much. So that's my thoughts on it.
When I'm playing this, I always like to think of it as building two mini teams, because that's the way it normally shakes down. You've got one left, one on the right. And I think what's key is making sure that your mini teams that you're setting out work together well. You don't want to have two brawly characters, for example. Let's say you've got two characters who've only got range two attacks. One of them needs to hang back and sit on your closer objective, and one of them needs to go and do something on the far objective. Both of those characters want to maybe go and be in the same place. It's better to try and pair up a melee-focused character with someone with at least a range four attack. They can be contributing to the fight as well. So thinking about your sub-teams that you're building within your team and making sure they complement each other well.
So we're going to move into Spider Infected and Cosmic Cubes next. I think this one's very interesting because you have five extracts to deal with. And it kind of like almost becomes interesting for stuff like the new tactics card of well-laid plans with Spider Foes and Web Warriors, Miles Phantom Blast, because he can just start going around making people drop the extracts. As well as, well-laid plans just makes everybody drop the objective tokens. But I also think, because we talked about this a little bit during our Web Warriors episode, where Cosmic Cubes is almost a trap because of how much damage they'll be taking. They're both very interesting scenarios because they can change the play field so much. Spider Infected and the facts of movements. So I feel like if you're playing Spider Infected, you want to have a very maneuverable team that they're not going to care too much if they get moved by the Spider Infected role. If you're banking on rolling bad every single turn and you're going to get forced to move, then you should plan for, well, I moved, it doesn't affect me much, I can move on. If you have a team that's full of a bunch of slow people, that being moved out of position is going to hurt them more than anything, that's something you're not really going to want to like plan to play in your team. As well with Cosmic Cubes, let's look at Web Warriors. They're all very low health characters, and picking up the cubes, sure, the extra power is nice, but they can't afford to be taking that damage out of out of a turn. And then it's just gonna make them easier to kill. It's gonna make it harder to just stay alive. So, but the power generation is nice. So it comes into teams that have a lot of health, or even Thanos, who's just gonna shirk all damage he takes. But that's kind of like Cosmic Cubes and Spider Infected. They're just pretty easy scenarios that it's like, it's obvious. Like, I want somebody who's maneuverable for Spider Infected, and I want somebody who's going to be able to withstand one damage every single turn with Cosmic Cubes, and then somebody who's going to benefit from that power gain. That's pretty much all my thoughts I have on these ones. I don't really think that the extracts modify your positioning on the field too much, just because it's across the whole entire field. And secures do that job more so than the extracts do anyways. But that's my thoughts on it.
Just to pick on something you mentioned there, Thanos will still take damage from the cubes because he only reduces enemy effects.
Ooh,
and this
correct.
Is not an enemy effect.
You are correct. My bad.
It is good for crossbones, but yeah, that's about it.
Yeah, I get it. Whoopsie.
Yeah, the big thing here is making sure you've got enough characters to get to where you need.
A random interaction with Crossbones, if you're carrying two cubes, he will take one damage because they combine the damage.
Mm-hmm.
I have some strong thoughts on these cards, but I don't know if, Jacob, you have anything you want to get out there.
It's really important to make sure you've got enough characters to hold all of those objectives, particularly for the Spider Infected, because you can only hold one of them. Mm-hmm. So that if you want to, at some point in the game, be holding four objectives, you've got to have four undazed characters that are able to do that. And the best way to have four undazed characters is to start with five of them.
Yeah. So that kind of plays to Guardians being pretty good, because they're more likely going to be a very wide list.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like these cards are built for the wide list. It's actually one of the big reasons to play a wide list right now in the game. Mm-hmm. And both of their negatives actually work fine with the wide list. So a list with, let's say, 6 to 7 characters, where most people are playing 4 to 5, their advantages are they have a lot of hit points. They should, because there's so many of them, right? If you think of characters that people play in wide, you have Drax, you have, Groot, and, you know, even Crossbones you could theoretically play, but I could, you know, in Valkyrie. Basically, the point is you have these like kind of beefy, tanky characters and a lot of them. Suffering the damage isn't so bad because it's spread out amongst many characters and they're even gaining more power, which means maybe more offensive output for them. Also, just in general, if you're going wide, the idea with these cubes is there's an odd number. There's 5 of them. So in theory, both people get 2 by default. Then there's the one in the middle. If you can get that one in the middle, then you are winning. Because in theory, you have your side and you have the one in the middle. That puts you up 1 VP every turn. So then you don't have to actually do anything aggressive. You could actually run away, play defensive, let your opponent move towards you, possibly waste actions. And your characters just hang out and try to build the best defense they can and win by doing nothing. So it puts the... It puts you in the driver's seat, right? The other example is the Infected. So they can, as Jacob had mentioned, you can only carry one at a time. So if your character's charging in already holding a Spider Infected and then kills or dazes someone holding it, another Spider Infected, you can't interact with it. It's just sitting there. So if you're playing a swarmy list, someone else can just go over and go get it.
Mm-hmm.
Those are basically ways to take the disadvantage of the objective and turn it into an advantage for you. And it's also hurting your opponent because they're taking damage on their characters and they have less characters than you do. They're getting moved. Spider Infected also is just bad for killing lists, usually with like turret type characters like MODOK. MODOK detests the spider infected. You don't even like, kind of don't even want him to pick one up at all, because you're basically getting staggered when that triggers, which I believe is a 50%, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so 50% of the time you're getting staggered on your 5-cost super character that's supposed to win you the game. That seems bad to me. So if you are playing against a kill list, which would probably be something like Cabal, but could really be lots of other things, that spider infect is pretty solid. You may take it. So if you're thinking about it, if you're not playing a swarm list, you may still want to take spider infected because it may be okay for you, but really bad for someone else. So that's worth it, right? When someone else is suffering and you're just managing okay. And to not suffer those consequences, you want characters with free movements, charges, you know, whatever different movement actions. Ghost Rider being a great example, since he gets the free move at, you know, when, with the 3 power. So that would be my and then 17 points is both of them are 17 point objectives, which the swarmy lists do pretty good with 17. You almost don't want to go up to like 20 with a swarm list, because now you're giving your opponent an opportunity to almost like catch up with you, where 17, it gets that awkward positioning where probably they only can comfortably fit 4 to 5 characters while you're happy with your 6 or 7. So that would be my final thoughts there.
So, Jacob, you give some insight to spider portals and deadly meteors next.
Okay. So this is picking up on what we touched on in the math section. Clearly, high energy defense is going to be something you're looking for. And as I mentioned before, medium energy defense and a push or a throw is also really, really good here. So looking for characters that have that baked in. The other really important interaction here is that it does cost a power to interact with. So round one, a lot of characters will have a choice between do they go and pick up an extract and spend their power to pick up the extract, or do they run and interact with the secure crisis? And that's a tough choice for a lot of characters. But for characters who start the round with multiple power or have ways of getting more power during the round, particularly when that doesn't require an action, this is a really strong crisis. So I'm thinking about things like the Asgardians, the Gem Bearers, people like Ebony Maw and Hulk, who just naturally generate more power. They're going to be better at these because they've got the versatility to both go and get an extract and also interact. The whole throughout the rest of the game as well, this is going to be a power soak. It's going to take power away from your characters that you're not using for superpowers or attacks. So again, those characters who generate more power are going to be advantaged in that.
Yep, having tanky characters that can take hits, it kind of reflects on this. It sort of fits the Outlast description I gave in our previous episode. It's maybe people who want to make the game go long, and they're just tend to be equipped to make a game, or they're equipped to survive to the late game, and a lot of that is more defensive than offensive, and that defense is rewarded with how this interaction works. It does tend to be a little bit of a King of the Hill scenario as well.
Mm-hmm.
If your list is built on avoiding fights or pushing people around, this is ineffective because the push actually has no impact on the objective itself. It might help you to score the objective, but the push itself isn't reducing their VP inherently on its own. The example would be Shuri. If you do a move and then shoot with Shuri on other secures, that's an effective play. On this, it's not.
The other thing that's worth mentioning is you can interact. You can't interact with each crisis element more than once, but you can interact with two different ones. You can interact with one move, potentially double move, and then interact with another one. So you can have quite impactful plays where you flip two of these over.
Yeah. That's awesome, actually.
So, Sploosh, what do you think about Extremis consoles and Cosmic Invasions?
Well, having played Extremis a few times, I've actually done what Jacob just described, where my character desperately needed to be healed. So I healed once on one what are they called, consoles, and then I ran over to the other console and healed on the other one. That was kind of cool. The Extremis console is something. The big part of the console is the fact it's map D, so that puts them pretty far away from each other with a giant gap in the middle. I believe the math is on a D that the home are furthest away from each other, and then the ones that are like going to be left or right are slightly closer than the distance between the homes. But it's a lot of distance. So I found with like a killing list like Cabal, I had trouble with extremists, and I decided I don't like it that much. In theory, I thought originally it was good for Cabal because they have extra power. They generate power, and having extra power is really solid with this because you heal with that power. And so you can turn a power into a health. So that's good for most characters, and some characters may get a little bit more efficiency out of that based on how many defensive dice they have or how hard it is to wound them. You can also heal other characters, which is something I didn't actually know until a few months ago. So it may be the character you're activating doesn't need the health, but as long as the character you want to heal is within range 2, that unwounded character can use the console to heal the wounded character. And that is actually pretty cool. However, the fact it's a D map and it requires a lot of power, it turns me off to lists that are power hungry. And then also maybe a list like a ball that has a lot of power, I didn't like it because it's so spread out and it kind of messed with my mobility and ability to react to how the game was going. I don't know, something about the way the Ds lay out, it's just awkward. Without fast moving characters, you can get yourself in some bad situations where you can be sort of stranded. I remember one game I played against someone, they had like the big bulky like Hulk and Thor, and they put them all on like a corner. And I kind of baited some of my stuff opposite side so that they committed to like moving in that direction. And then I promptly repositioned like my entire list to the opposite side of the board. And then they had to choose to leave behind the VP point that they were on to go after me or leave someone on it to keep up the score. And so you can put people that are playing like a really greedy list into an awkward situation where if they chase after you, they're leaving VPs behind. And if they leave the character behind, they're losing out on the value of that character. You know, if you leave Hulk behind, you're losing 6 points, you know, in your roster. So the D scenario is tricky. Cosmic Invasion, as we discussed too, with the positioning, it's one of those objectives where if the map is, you know, favoring you and you put down that token and there's like that perfect light post, you can actually position your character with geometry so that the push away just doesn't do anything. And so you can turn that negative into a positive. And a big, I mean, maybe there's a theme here, but the goal of all of these is you look at the what the negative is and trying to turn that into a positive. So if you do roll the result that causes you to be pushed, that will give you power. So this is an objective that's good for lists that need power. And maybe the push away is annoying, but like as I said, you can counter it. And it is also a D formation. So everything I said previously about D holds true here as well. To be honest, I don't know that there's much more to say about it other than Cosmic Invasion is a 16-point objective, and that's unique to the game and still very new. Possibly there's a situation where you look at your opponent's list and the 15 or 17-point rosters are very obvious, but you can see a hole or a gap in their strategy, and you're like, I don't think their 16 is very good. Because a lot of people have muscle memory with the number 17 and 15, but not much with 16.
I think there are a couple of things I wanted to add. The first thing is that when you are sitting on one of those points on the D map, even if you have a range 5 attack, you cannot target you cannot hit someone who's on another one of those points. They are just too far away. Now, if they position badly or they position really close, then it is possible. But with good positioning, your character, even with a range 5 attack, is not going to be able to impact one of those other secure points. That's not always true, because you can get characters like Hawkeye who have the ability to do an extra move as well. So you can move off your secure point, make an attack, and then use your special ability to move back. So characters who can do that, who can camp a point and still impact other points, are really, really valuable on these D maps. That's one thing I wanted to say. The other one is this, and Sploosh kind of mentioned this briefly, the idea of redeployment. This is a kind of map where you can try and neutralize your opponent's biggest threats, not by dazing them, but by making your characters not be where they are. Let's say you're facing off against Corvus with a reality gem, and he runs down and comes down one of the side flanks and goes, right, well, I'm going to beat up anyone who comes down here. Don't send anyone that way. Send them all off to the left on the other side and keep them away from. And then you've got it. You're putting your opponent into that position where they're having to make that awkward decision that Sploosh described.
So next, we're going to be talking about the evacuees. So I personally love this scenario. It's probably the one I've played the most. I like it because it can be very Sweeney. If you have two objectives and you just so happen to have 6 points on both those characters, that's a 4-point swing in your favor. For me personally, I think affiliations that do really well with power, so you got like Cabal, Avengers, and then if you take somebody with a power gem, it even amplifies it even more because you take that power gem and you're scoring a evacuee by round two if you really wanted to. Some things to really think about with this scenario, in my opinion, is how, like, when do you want to cash in that citizen? A lot of times I kind of went with the mindset of, if my person's in threat, sure, cash it in. And then if not, cash in by round three. And then if you can even get your opponent's citizens and cash them in, it's, again, it's a huge point swing. And I typically found that the citizens, it's probably one of the fastest scenarios because of that aspect. Just in my experience, I think it really speeds up the game, and you should be like ready for that. Just think about like how much of a point swing could this affect me, when to cash in and take people that are easy to get power or able to. Like the Cabal, I think Cabal's a good example because you're able to get that extra power off of it. But that's pretty much down in it for his, other than the fact of it's the widespread as well, like Infinity formula, where it's on either side of the map, and you have that big dead space in the middle, depending on your secure. But that's basically all my thoughts are on evacuees. It's pretty simple. It's high power generation, people love it, and being mindful of when you cash in that citizen.
The only thing I think I'd add to that is this is something Omnus talks about in bold plays, and I think this is the scenario that best suits those. That idea of reaching across the table and taking an objective that your opponent thinks is theirs. So having a character either with a long move or a medium move, but a 50mm base or bigger, so that they can double move and grab that objective. Someone like Hela is a great example of someone who can get there and is then relatively survivable to survive what's going to be thrown at them. And even if they do get dazed, then they've got good ways of spending power. Black Panther's another great one. He's pretty survivable, as long as he's not going up against a whole load of mystic attacks. And he's got great ways to spend the power if he does get dazed. So those kind of those bold plays where you're trying to grab three evacuees and then potentially get them all off the table as quickly as possible and score those points and remove the ability for your opponent to catch up, that can be a very effective strategy. But it is also a risky one.
Yeah, my two cents on this card is, first of all, the fact that it's a 19 on the score. It's going to be often a lot of characters. And I do agree with Jacob that it's one of those objectives that I kind of tend to position mid-board because I have to always respect the fact that someone could try to steal one of my citizens. The fact that you can score two VPs mid-game is insane. Sometimes you can play a turn ahead and look at the board and say, okay, all I have to do is get to 14 VPs, and the next turn, especially if I have, initiative? Am I saying that right?
Priority.
Priority, thank you. I knew I was missing the word. Then you know you won. I mean, sometimes your opponent might even be caught off guard because you're kind of like, all right, that's the end of the round, and I'm going to score this citizen, and the game's over. And sometimes people just think, huh, what? That's actually, I think, pretty unique to this game, that someone could just instantly win in the middle of the round. I think that catches people off guard just in general, the first time it happens to you. So it's something to be aware of. It definitely favors characters that can gain a lot of power. Hawkeye actually comes to mind because he doesn't have many power sinks. So, and he's probably very commonly going to grab a civilian. So characters like that, even Shuri. And that actually combos a little bit with the objective I described earlier, the affinity formula, since it's the exact same map. And that map favors long-range characters that can kind of hang out. Also, though, if you are playing on Infinity Formula, you have to be really careful that your citizen isn't stolen. Being able to score the citizen is a cool way to sort of get out of that. So if your opponent's pushing aggressively on one side of the board, you can get rid of the citizen so they can't, they kind of don't get their bounty, you know? And that can be very effective and waste a lot of your opponent's time if they're spending a lot of energy on stealing your civilian and then, you know, they don't get it. On the other way around, the flip side of that is if you're playing a killing list and someone's holding a civilian and you kill a character standing right next to it and you have a boatload of power because of how much damage you just did, you can instantly score those VPs. And maybe in that same round, you would have lost the civilian, but now you just kind of gobbled it up and it's gone. They can't get it back. It also is similar to how I was describing cubes, where... Creating an odd number of VPs is very important to this game, because if you can create that odd number in your favor, you don't have to really do anything anymore. It's just something in gaming in general, you want to identify your win condition. And sometimes people, you know, they're on the gas and they're killing their opponent and everything's going right for them, and they don't correctly identify that they're winning and keep doing that same action. And it might put their opponent back in the game. But if you can see yourself and how you're winning, and you can, you kind of realize, like, okay, I ate the civilian, I control two civilians, my opponent controls one civilian. All I have to do now is keep parity and I win. If you can identify that, it's really important to the game. And so that's where this, talking about the secure, it's really, or extract, it's really important to identify those strengths and weaknesses. You can only carry one. That's also kind of bit me in the butt a few times, where I get really excited because I tell my opponent, I'm going to take that civilian, and then it's like, oh no, can only carry one. So that's also something that I feel like is a common mistake. But otherwise, about all I can say, I do find this to be a very good objective for killing type lists.
I just want to say, I think it's hilarious that you say you eat the citizens and you're trying to save them.
Oh, well, yeah, I guess the cabal, so I'm not helping them. I'm actually consuming them for energy.
Makes sense. Jacob, do you want to give us the down and dirty on gamma shelters?
So there's kind of two schools of thought on gamma, and I think that Sploosh and I fall on very different sides of this. The first is you're going to be seeing a lot of characters bunched up in the center. And that is, you know, feeding frenzy for people with beam attacks or who can make multiple attacks against people. There can be, you know, I'm going to get a load of damage done to you. And I'm going to then, once I've attritioned your team down, I'm going to be able to score a load of points and get a win that way. So you can go for characters who really want to focus on that. Anyone with a reliable beam that they can get off. Anyone who can make multiple attacks. So things like Cap's shield throw, ricochet, things like MODOK's Doomsday Chair. There are some great characters out there who can target multiple targets. That's one approach to this. The other approach to this is to go, this is the scenario in which you can score the most victory points. In theory, you can get 6 victory points if you can control all 3 of the gamma shelters. So another approach to it is to say, rather than going for killing beatdown, I want to have priority, I'm going for the control push throw type list, which is going to want to go last and have someone like Shuri, who's got the ability to move potentially 2 people off those shelters so that I can control them, so that I can get ahead without even necessarily needing to make any attacks. You could win a game where you don't make an attack unless it involves a push with it as well. That sort of weaponizes those pushes, because once you can use those pushes to get out of the range 2 of the gamma shelter, and then they're taking damage as well. So that can then, if you need to spin on the dime and suddenly go into attack mode, they've been nickel and dimed down a bit so that they're easier to take down in order for that big turn, which can potentially win you the game.
Okay. So, and I differ from you because I'd use it to kill people in a mosh pit, and you'd use it to be control-y and just score points to win.
Yeah.
I think, too, it's worth mentioning that this card can single-handedly invalidate other cards, like other secures. No, I'm sorry, other extracts. I keep saying that backwards. But yeah, you can sort of ignore some extracts and just say, I'm not going to worry about your extract. I'm going to just score your base and get 1,000,000 points. Is that valid?
Absolutely. Now, if you really want to amp this up, then you probably do need to get a few points off the extract. I find that even if you're going hyper control, you're looking at maybe 5 points off the first turn, and then you're trying to get six. You're getting 3 points from the gamma shelters off the first turn, and then trying to get six for the next two. That only puts you on 15, and typically, that kind of team wants to really try and win it by round three, by the end of round three. So you're going to need to try and get some points from an extract, even if that's only one or two.
Yeah, so I'm talking more like Skrulls and alien ship. But you could theoretically try to get the Skrull in the middle of this board, so it's not completely out of...
Yeah. And typically those teams have extra characters because they're trying to lose priority. So they've got a character that they can just throw and roll some dice, and hopefully it happens.
I will just say I like the idea of what you're saying, where it's a control-friendly map. And I agree with you. Often those control lists are very consistent lists because their effects are generally not RNG-based. Mm-hmm. So that's very true about them. But I do, from talking with some of my experienced opponents, Gamma Wave, for me, I don't enjoy it that much, even though I play it in basically every roster. And the reason I don't enjoy it is it's a low point total. And what ends up happening is usually playing like four characters if you're playing the kind of smashy list that most people enjoy. And what ends up happening is if someone gets a spike in any way, the game kind of loses control quickly and it becomes a bit of a snowball. And then someone's scoring so many points so quickly. I actually lost the finals on this map and my opponent scored 10 VP in one turn. So I was winning something like, 12-6 or something, or I don't know, maybe I had 10-6, but I was pretty convincingly winning. And then in one turn, I got kind of spiked on and my opponent scored 10 and 6 turned into 16 VPs and the game instantly ended. So it's a very spiky map. Generally, the games are very quick. Even if you're playing control or if you're playing aggression, both games are quick games usually. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. And the stats bear that out. It's by far the quickest crisis.
I think when some people first start playing this game, they picture like every game goes to six turns, and this secure. That generally, I think the games end on turn three.
Yeah.
So some people may not find that very fun. I just RNG isn't just rolling dice. Sometimes it's how the game turns out, and this I feel like this secure puts the game in a very RNG scenario where, like I said, dice spikes when someone's attacking you, it can get a little awkward. So, it's undeniably a counter card, and that's why I keep playing it. Even though I don't like what it's doing, it's kind of like Wakanda and Herb slows the game down against certain lists. This one is pretty good for the killie teams to sort of keep lists honest. For example, a swarmy list might not like this because they want to like go out and grab things, or their characters are forced to be in this like little ball, and having like a beam, you could just kind of wipe out like two or three characters in one blast. Or you're playing characters like, even though you're saying Wakanda is good on it, and they are, they also don't like to fight. And when I'm playing a list that does like to fight, at least people are kind of forced to stay in a close proximity to me, and it allows me to capitalize on characters like MODOK. And also some smart play can negate some of the push effects in this game.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
Yeah, and that's more of a higher tier strategy, but you can position characters in such a way that they don't get pushed as well as maybe the opponent hopes. But yeah, that's about it for that.
Moving on, Do you want to finish this off with Hammer Sploosh?
Yeah, sure. I mean, at this point, Hammer is, I mean, it's a D map. We've really exhausted discussion on D. The real twist to this is when you pick up a hammer, you get one additional attack die, and you have to pay an extra point of power when you use a tactics card. That can be a little rough sometimes, for sure, but some characters, they don't even play tactics cards, so they don't really care that much. The plus one damage can make the game very explosive, and if you're playing a list that likes killing, it's definitely pretty cool to have extra dice. You know, you can really have some fun with this this extract. This is definitely an extract that maybe makes people play. But, you know, we were talking about this civilians, right? The citizens, and how people try to steal citizens. I feel like trying to gain an advantage by sort of stealing a hammer is pretty key to playing this objective. And the objectives are very aggressively positioned with the D, so the D map. And what that means is you can not only steal the hammers, but you can also kind of get punished for taking hammers more easily. There are some cool, cute combos where you can have, like, say, Hawkeye do, like, double move, grab a hammer, and then jump back. It requires the assistance from Wong or R&D, and you need to be in Avengers to do it. But you do have to be mindful of little combos with this card. I don't know. Do you guys feel like I missed anything? I mean, there's not a lot more to say on this. The actual strategy itself is very similar to the other affiliations.
I think that's true. One thing that I do think Hammers favors is turn one scripted plays. Typically, those involve team tactics cards. And if you're playing those team tactics cards and getting value out of them in round one, then you're not having to pay the extra power for them later in the game when you've got characters with hammers. So if you've got a really good turn one drop-off play, then that's probably going to be even better in hammers.
So one thing that I would add is being wary of picking up multiple hammers on one character. It seems like a good idea at the time, but then all of your eggs are in one basket, literally. When I was playing Guardians a lot, I loved hammers because throwing a hammer on Star-Lord for his element gun was really fun. And even more so for full auto, but there were times where I'd find him with 2 to 3 hammers on him and super squishy character, and he just basically feeding all the hammers to your opponent, and it just, you lose that point swing, they get the point swing, and end up taking the game from you because you had literally all of your hammers on one dude. So I would say try to stay away from doing tactics like that. It may seem like a good idea, but most of the time it's not, unless it's like towards the end of the game and you really need to daze that one person, and having multiple hammers on one person is like, well, I'm going to have like a 14, 15 die Hulk with 3 hammers on them. It can be beneficial, but I would say don't. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's also difficult to objectively evaluate which affiliations are good in hammers, because it feels like everybody likes having hammers. And it's going to be true that it benefits some affiliations more than others. And I certainly don't have a handle on, oh, I think this affiliation is really good in hammers, because they kind of all feel good, you know, for a killie list, you getting extra dice. But for a team that wants to play fast, you've got 4 extracts and, you know, you can use that to your advantage. So there's sort of something for everyone here. And think really critically about, is it actually better for your affiliation than it is for the affiliations you're going to be going against?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and you could, I touched on this in the last episode, but you might be the objective list, but maybe your opponent is also an objective list, and all of a sudden you became the killie list just by default. So maybe all of a sudden hammers just got better for you than your opponent. That's why the game is very dynamic in that way. And who's the beatdown kind of concept of maybe it's better for you in this game than you thought it would be. Also, don't become tunnel visioned with always attacking. Sometimes that hammer is this game winning VP and you need to just run away with it.
I think that's something, because I've had this conversation with Jacob before, actually. Jacob, do you want to like go into that a little bit? Like, when is the right time to run away?
I think looking at the board state and looking at your VP track and constantly going, how many VPs do I need to win? And sometimes it's going to be the case that you want to just go, well, if I can score one this round and then I can run away even further next round, then that's two. And that's going to put me over the top, because whereas if I lose it, maybe that swings it to my opponent because I've lost one and they've gained one. In tight games, you want to be looking and planning for your end game from around about turn round three, round four. You need to be looking at your VP track and going, now might be the right sort of time to run away. I think another thing you sort of touched on then is, when is the right time to not attack? And I think you need to kind of have an eye on, if I attack my opponent, what are they going to do with that power? What superpowers are they going to use on me? What spender attacks can they now afford because I've given them that power? The reprisal that I'm going to get might cause me to drop this hammer and lose that VP. So that's another side of that coin.
Well, do you guys have any more final thoughts on crisis selection and why it's important to help you improve your game?
Yeah, I think this is one of the hardest things, is to figure out what crises are going to work well and what teams work well and what crises. And that ties in with what we were talking about in the previous episode in roster building. It's such an integral thing, and it's something which gets overlooked by newer players until they've got a bit more experience. So hopefully some of you have got some ideas now which you can take into your roster building.
Well, that wraps it up for this episode of The Danger Room. We hope you enjoyed it and learned something to level up your next game. You can reach out to us on our Discord, Twitter, or Facebook. The links will be in the description. We have a questions channel on our Discord, so feel free to drop us some questions in there and we'll answer them on the show. Thank you for taking the time and listening to us. If you're liking what you hear, leave a rating or comment, or even both. We appreciate any feedback to help us grow and become a better group to bring you the best quality content that we can. See you next time in the Danger Room.